If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by HappyTummy.ie, the exclusive distributor of BioGaia probiotics in Ireland. Discover BioGaia Gastrus, a clinically proven probiotic for a balanced gut and improved well-being. BioGaia's probiotics, featuring Lactobacillus reuteri, are renowned for their trustworthiness and effectiveness. With origins dating back to the dawn of humanity, these probiotics are scientifically proven to support your entire gastrointestinal tract. And here's some great news for our Baby Tribe listeners. Enjoy a 10% discount on all BioGaia products at happytummy.ie by using the code BABYTRIBE10 at checkout. Invest in your gut health today with happytummy.ie and BioGaia. Welcome to the Baby Tribe podcast, your essential companion through the journey of parenting. I'm Professor Afif Al-Kafash, a neonatologist, pediatrician, researcher, and lactation consultant at the Rotunda Hospital Dublin and the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland.
And I'm Katie Mugan, a pediatric and public health nurse and a lactation consultant. Together, with over 40 years of experience in caring for infants and children, we're here to share expert insights, inspiring stories, and give you access to an amazing array of experts in parenting and the field of pediatrics.
Before we dive into today's topic, remember to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform. Your ratings and reviews help us reach more parents like you, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Now, let's get started with today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Baby Tribe podcast. We are hoping that you're really enjoying our season so far. I know that I've been enjoying making it with you, Katie. What do you think?
I have, but guys, do you know what? Every time I sit down beside Afif, he actually says the same thing. I feel like I'm sitting with my husband sometimes. Don't move your hands. Stop touching the table. Like, he's such a perfectionist.
Well, you know, these are things that us producers have to worry about. You know, we don't have a Joe like, you know, like Ghosted Me. We don't have a Joe that tells us what to do or where to look or how loud to speak. I have to do it all myself. And I don't think you appreciate the effort that I put into making our podcast sound really nice. And you know that I'm doing a course.
I was just about to say, now guys, this has just started since he's doing his course. I'm going to have to deal with his inflated ego once he finishes.
Speaking of husbands, who did you call yesterday by mistake instead of calling your husband?
I know, and I wouldn't mind. I was just about to give out over one of the kids. And then I was like, hello? And I was like, that's not Jim. And it was Afif.
So she called me instead of her husband. So it's finally,
that's a compliment, though,
it's finally happening. So I must be on her speed dial list.
You're very, number two in my phone book.
I'm very
privileged.
I'm very flattered and privileged. Absolutely. So what did your child do that you were going to give out to them about? Did they have a temper tantrum or maybe a meltdown?
No, but mom did. Over gum shields. The amount of gum shields we lose on a weekly basis is just ridiculous.
Yeah. My wife was talking to me earlier, worried about our son, that he's forgetful. And recently he lost his entire gym kit in the school. Like, we just spent so much money getting him the gym kit, because you know these school uniform ones cost a fortune, and he's lost two pairs, lost his gym bag, we don't know where it is. And then she goes, I think he has a serious problem that we need to address. And I keep telling her his serious problem is that he's a 13-year-old boy. And then I was beginning to get where it sits, thinking maybe he does have a problem, until you came and told me a story this morning.
So then I arrived and I said, oh my God, I've just received a text from Jim, because I was giving out, because my 13-year-old went and left his hurling gear for his hurling training after school today. And he actually left his gym bag in front of the front door, which meant he had to step over it to leave the house. And he forgot it. He's normal.
Yeah, exactly. He's normal.
Like, or whatever you perceive normal to be.
And do men ever grow out of this?
Oh, well, you see, that's our challenge, is that Jim is the complete opposite.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no. They are like chalk and cheese in that way.
Yeah.
But he's like my brother. And this is like one of the episodes we spoke about before, you know, the Irish mammies and how they enable things.
Yeah.
My mother enabled my brother, so I'm under strict instructions. I'm not allowed to enable Luke.
So you give out to him?
Yeah, well, no, I didn't. I said I'd drop it down to him on his way.
Oh, so he's not going to learn the lesson. He's going to forget again and he'll say, my mom's going
to
drop it.
I know, but I don't want him to miss out on his hurling practice.
So. Yeah, that's fair enough. We have a very relevant and I think good episode for you guys today. We are going to talk about autism spectrum disorder and also understanding temper tantrums in relation to ASD and in relation to children without this condition as well. This episode would be relevant to I think any parent, regardless of whether they have a child that they're worried about or they have a child with a confirmed diagnosis of ASD. Because what we are going to do in our chat before we bring in our guest is talk about the myths associated with autism spectrum disorder. And there are many of them. And one of the biggest ones that we want to address is what, Katie?
That vaccines cause autism.
And that has been one of the biggest pervasive myths about ASD. So much so that we're now seeing a measles outbreak because the rates of MMR vaccine have significantly dropped in Ireland in order to maintain herd immunity, meaning that we need enough protection to, you know, prevent the spread of it and also protect children under a year of age that can't avail of the vaccine yet. We need to have a vaccination rate of around 95%. And for years and years and years, Ireland have maintained that, but it has now significantly dropped. Some counties, Katie, actually have a vaccination rate as low as 80% and sometimes lower, which means that we are vulnerable to a spread of measles. And to try and debunk this myth once and for all, I think it's important to look at the history of why this myth came about. And it actually dates back to a study that was done, that was published in The Lancet in 1998 by a Dr. Andrew Wakefield and his colleagues. And The Lancet is a pretty prestigious medical journal, so people tend to believe the results of a study that's published in it. And the publication of this study unfortunately caused a widespread concern that led to a significant decrease in vaccination rates, as well as an increase in outbreaks of vaccine preventable diseases like the one we're seeing with measles right now. What the study showed initially was that there could have been a link between getting your MMR, which kids get in and around 12 to 13 months of age, and the development of autism. But the study actually had a lot of methodological problems that weren't addressed at the time. A few of the problems I think it's important to outline to show you how, you know, so something that is incorrect spread like wildfire before people had a chance to actually critically appraise it or have critical thinking in order to address it. So let's talk about why the study was debunked. Well, the first big thing was that there was a lack of reproducibility, meaning that many other studies involving actually millions of children worldwide consistently showed no link between the MMR vaccine and autism. So despite multiple studies that came after the study showing that there was no link, people still believed the original study. There was also a lot of ethical and methodological flaws in it. Did you know, apparently, that the main doctor involved in the study had a conflict of interest that he didn't disclose? He actually filed a patent for a rival vaccine that he was planning to profit from to try and replace the MMR. So people think that it was a way of trying to discredit the MMR so that his vaccine can be taken up instead. Furthermore, it was actually discovered that he manipulated the data to make the link look significant and strong. The paper was actually pulled and retracted in 2010. So it took 12 years for The Lancet to say, okay, this paper is bogus and we are going to retract it, meaning that we don't believe the results. And the Journal Medical Council actually in the UK found him guilty of professional misconduct and he was struck off the register, meaning that he could no longer actually practice as a doctor. The problem is that study had a massive public health impact. People still afraid of giving the MMR vaccine. I'm still hearing these concerns and trying to explain to parents and outlining the methodological issues can sometimes be hard when you're trying to convince them to give a vaccine. And I think the media played a significant role in spreading this false information very, very quickly. And we still have ongoing efforts to try and rebuild the trust with the public about vaccines. And that made people very skeptic about other vaccines as well. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and I suppose it used to be given at 18 months and we brought it back to a year because often around the 18 months is where we can see a change in development, where they could be progressing quite well and they start retracting in some of their developments. So a lot of the time, I suppose, as parents, we always try to find the answer when something happens to our kids. And I suppose when it happened, when the vaccination was given and then they see this sudden change in the development, that's how they linked it. Then plus you have this doctor that comes out and says it is linked. So you can understand where parents are coming from.
Yeah.
But now because it's given at one, and that's why we try to bring it back at the age of one, so you can actually see the child will have progressed way further than that at the time. So there's no, like in the mind of the parents, there is no connection.
Yeah, and if you look at the prevalence of ASD in Ireland, it affects 1.5% of the population. So it's a significant enough number. And if everybody's getting the vaccine, and then some people or some children are developing symptoms that are concerning for ASD, and we're going to talk about these symptoms with our interviewer later on, you could see how people can actually make the link. I hope that we clarified this a little bit more. So let's move on to the other myths that are associated with it. So what other myths are there?
Yeah, the next one, I suppose, is the poor parenting can cause autism. Yeah. That it's something that the parents have done that have led to this development.
And even sometimes I've heard this horrible term. I don't know if you've heard it before. The refrigerator mother, the cold mother that doesn't engage with her children, that doesn't give them enough attention. Again, blaming women for something that is genetically sometimes predetermined is absolutely ridiculous. So poor parenting does not actually lead to autism. And it's important to stress that this disorder has a genetic background. So some kids are actually conditioned to end up with this condition. And also, there are some environmental factors that may play a role, but that's not been definitively proven. So we still think that it has a big genetic basis behind it.
Yeah, there's a lot more information coming out. We see it on social media all the time. You know, food, diets or allergies is linked to autism as well.
And we know that diet and gastrointestinal issues can affect the behavior of children with autism, but there is actually no evidence that food allergies or dietary choices cause autism. But if you improve the diet, of course, behaviors will improve because the child is generally going to be in a better health condition. That doesn't mean that a food allergy or a certain diet or certain food items can actually cause the condition. And that's really important to emphasize.
Yeah, so true. And the next then is autism is caused by watching prolonged amounts of TV. Now, this is about our screen times and technology, which we've spoken about numerous times. But you'll often hear that parents are still kind of nearly being blamed. Well, your child watched too much TV, it has led to autism.
Yes, and screen time, and we've talked about this the last time, it's often scrutinized for its impact on children's development. However, there's no scientific evidence to support the claim that screen time or technology usage actually cause autism. And we talked about the chicken and egg, and we spoke about last time how kids that may have early symptoms of autism or they are likely to develop autism down the line are more drawn to screens than other kids without this condition. So it's not the fact that screen time causes autism, it's that kids with potential or early autism are more likely to watch longer screen time. So that's, again, that's important to emphasize. Yes, minimizing screen time is important, but screen time does not cause autism.
No, and sometimes for parents, this is a little bit of downtime for them where it can be very intense and the screens can help support them at times during, parenting periods.
Yes, they can be a very helpful tool. And in a future episode of The Baby Tribe, we are actually going to have a cyber psychologist coming on talking about screen time, talking about video gaming and talking about social media.
Oh my God, I can't wait for that one.
Yeah, that's going to be a really, really good one.
See, Aviv surprises me all the time.
I met her in my podcast course, actually.
Oh my God, this is what I'm going to have to listen to nonstop over the next season.
Yeah, so I'm telling you, it's great and can't wait to have her on to talk about these things.
Great.
So Katie, let's pause for a moment to remind our listeners that Baby Tribe is now part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, and we are now in a position to offer our listeners bonus content via Head Stuff Plus.
That's right, Afif. Our spin-off series, Keeping Up with the Kafashians, hosted by you and your lovely wife, Anne Doherty, treats our listeners to the fabulous husband and wife discussions and expansion of points raised here on the Baby Tribe and some science as well.
So please subscribe for as little as €5 per month and make sure to select Baby Tribe and Keeping Up with the Kafashians as your podcast to support. Subscribing will give you access to all the bonus content on Head Stuff Plus. And guys, Katie's weekly appearance fees are getting a bit much for me, so we'd really value your support.
I wish everyone. Afif's skincare routine is ridiculous. You should see the potions and lotions he uses every single day.
Listen, it takes a lot to look this good. Thank you to everyone who have subscribed so far. And if you haven't subscribed yet, why the hell not?
This is how it's always been.
Double Love is a podcast in which we explore the strange and terrifying world of Sweet Valley High, book by book. Join me, Anna Carey.
And me, Karen Moynihan.
As we revisit one of the maddest series of books ever written, or ghost written.
If you ever read about Elizabeth and Jessica, the perfect blonde Wakefield twins, then you might enjoy listening to us absolutely tearing them to shreds. Affectionately, of course.
Of course. And even if you didn't, there's still plenty of drama, kidnapping, stolen boyfriends and school dances to entertain you.
Find us on the Head Stuff Podcast Network and wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell me now, temper tantrums. Did your kids suffer from temper tantrums?
Absolutely. I think most kids will hit it at some stage. And we often see it kind of around the age, I suppose, 1 to 3. Kids don't have the ability to use the vocabulary. They haven't reached that point. So you'll see where they'll have like a little mini breakdown where they want something. They don't have the vocabulary to be able to converse and tell you what they want. And when they don't get the response they want, they generally can take to the ground. They can scream and shout. They can make it pretty public.
What about husbands? Do they have temper tantrums?
Do you know what? I'd say, you know, yes, Jim definitely does. Sometimes I think I might be worse.
I've been told that I may have had a temper tantrum or two in the past, but you know.
Oh, I could imagine you.
Yeah. Yeah. I blame my childhood.
Poor, his poor mom. I hope she's not listening to this.
One thing I didn't know, and I don't know if I should be admitting this publicly or not, but you know, I don't know everything. There she goes. She knocked
I just
on
hit
the
table, guys. I just hit the table.
It's fine.
I'm getting the dagger eyes.
I'll try and edit it out. Temper tantrums and meltdowns are not the same thing. In fairness, the terms are used interchangeably, but I think it's important to distinguish between the two. So I've done a little bit of research and we do talk about this with our guest as well. As you said, temper tantrum, they are triggered by frustration or a desire to achieve something. It's almost a way of communication. Mm-hmm. And this something could be, you know, avoiding an unwanted task or wanting something that you're not allowed to have. And the individual still has a level of control, or the child still has a level of control over their behavior. And they can sometimes be calmed down through negotiation or by achieving their desired outcome. So it's a kid's way of telling you what they want or refusing to do something. They are sort of in control of it. They sometimes may
be, to a certain extent, yeah.
Yeah, they may be overwhelmed with the feeling because the behavior can include yelling, crying, stomping feet. And they are generally goal-oriented and subside once either the goal is met or the child or the individual realizes the behavior won't achieve the desired result. The one that Ada really, really like is, it's for a supermarket, I can't remember which one, of the child wanting a packet of sweets and the mother says no and he starts having a temper tantrum on the floor and then she goes down on the floor and has the same temper tantrum and he just looks at her going, what are you doing? You look like an idiot. And yeah, then she just gives him the look saying, and move on. I love that.
Yeah, it's pretty true though. Like they nearly always end up doing it in public.
Yeah.
Because they probably know that then it's going to be a win-win situation.
See, they're in control of it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas a meltdown, on the other hand, is actually a reaction to being overwhelmed. And you could be overwhelmed by sensory overload or intense frustration or a sudden change in your environment. And it could, although, happen to anybody as well. And meltdowns manifest as full body reaction, where the person may lash out, run away, shut down, or withdraw. And unlike tantrums, meltdowns aren't aimed at achieving a specific outcome and won't stop because a demand is met. So they typically end when the sensory input is reduced or the individual becomes too exhausted to continue. So as you can see, they are different. And it's important to recognize the difference because dealing with them is different.
Yes. We have one child that would have meltdowns.
Really?
Yeah, and he would just struggle. And like people would say, oh, it's just him. But I think from the outside of other people looking in, they could look and say, God, he looks like a bold kid. He's not responding. That's a real temper tantrum when it's completely different. Like you can try, you know, give him what he wants. That won't stop it.
Yeah.
It's that he's so overloaded. And oftentimes by the end you go, why were you so upset? And he'll go, I don't know. I just couldn't stop it. But it's for others to understand that they are very different. And this is where, because we use them interchangeably, a temper tantrum and meltdown, people don't see them as different.
Yeah. So I hope that we clarified that while temper tantrums are common in all children, usually most children will experience tantrums. Absolutely.
And adults.
And adults as well. They're a response to frustration. Meltdowns are a response to overwhelming situations that are not in any way the child is seeking attention, but it's rather an expression of feeling overwhelmed by the environment or internal stressors.
Yeah.
Now, meltdowns can happen in children without...
I was just about to say,
yeah,
they're not automatically linked with ASD.
Yeah.
Any child can have them. It just depends on their own individual needs.
They can just be more frequent in children that have issues with sensory processing. The myth that then kids that display these conditions, tantrums or meltdowns, are spoilt or poorly disciplined.
No, I don't agree.
Yeah, I don't agree either, absolutely. I think people should understand that you're only seeing a snapshot if you're observing a child with a meltdown or a tantrum in a public space and you're looking at the parents bewildered or unable to navigate the situation. Don't pass judgment.
Absolutely. I think most parents nowadays would look with empathy. Most of us have been in that situation at that time.
Yeah.
So I think it's actually just supporting. Like, I've seen people where they have toddlers having an absolute meltdown at the checkout and they've got another kid in tow. So like, if you are, offer help. Help them put the groceries on the
I was actually just going to ask, and that's something I've been thinking about. Should you offer help, or is that going to make the parents feel
awkward? I'd always offer
help.
If they don't want it, then they step away. Like, sometimes in those situations where it's very significant and a child is having an absolute moment and you're in the middle of a shopping centre, I think it's easier just to pack up and leave. Take your battles on. Like, I wouldn't work through that. You get so stressed out yourself. Sometimes just taking a breather and leaving that environment is probably a better place for both of you to, a better thing for both of you to do.
And you've touched on an amazing point, because our interview with Dr. Quinn coming up shortly, she talks about how the parents should also self-regulate or regulate themselves or keep themselves calm, or trying to get to a calm situation before they deal with their child.
And I think that's really important for the meltdowns, because how you respond will lead to how your child will react. And I think sometimes, as parents, and I say this from myself, that I could be caught off guard by one of his meltdowns and I could be triggered and then I would snap. And when I snap, it escalates way further. Whereas if I know I can keep calm, we could be through it way quicker. So a lot of it's how we respond to the child.
Yeah.
And we work in together.
I don't think I would like to meet Katie when she snaps.
Oh, yeah, no. Well, do you know what? Yeah, I'm just flighty. I could just flick. Yeah. It's like a flick switch, but I'm really, and you know, there's times where even with these meltdowns and tantrums, and I think it's important to say, we should all realize when we have to say sorry. As parents, I would often say, oh, I'm sorry, I snapped. I shouldn't have. That's not how I should have reacted. I'll say it to the kids. I'll be honest.
So do you snap, or do you slowly escalate your anger?
Oh, it depends on who I'm dealing with. Really? If it's Jim, it could be a quick snap. Generally, the kids just keep on going. In my house, I'm a bit of a shouter. It's probably my worst trait. But I grew up in a shouty house where my mom would like to shout, but it was like how we spoke to each other. Yeah. It wasn't necessarily vicious or violent. We would shout. So I could be shouting at the kids and nobody would even acknowledge that I'm shouting louder and louder until I hit to the point when they go, she's about to lose it. They all know my tone. Whereas Jim would go from 0 to 100. And I'm like, Jim, where's the white line? You ran past it. You didn't even give them a warning sign. Bring it right back down.
So it's so funny, because that's exactly how the situation is in the Elkafash household. I think that's why you and Anne get on so well. You're so similar.
I love Anne.
Yeah, you're so similar. Anyway, I think we'll conclude our chat by stressing the importance of empathy, patience, and recognizing that you're only seeing a snapshot of families in a situation like this. And also to seek accurate information and to approach families in difficult situations with understanding and kindness. And just remember that as healthcare providers, we have no skin in the game of trying to trick you into getting a vaccine and relaying information that is not truthful. We just think that the importance of looking at the information with a critical eye, to actually look at the information yourself and see, does it make sense or does it not make sense? I understand that can be difficult sometimes for people that are not, you know, in the medical profession or used to reading scientific papers. This is where we come in to try and break it down for you. What do you think?
Absolutely. And if you have questions, remember there is a HSE vaccination consultant that will actually talk things through if you're really, really worried. But start with your GP first. Just to also mention that, you know, I know many of us, when it comes to, you know, behaviours with our kids and that, if you're struggling, just know that there is help out there. Within the HSE, your public health nurse, your health nursing service, there are clinical psychologists that deal with our kids, and they will do phone calls with you. They can help you away. So that is a free service that's available. They generally do weekly phone calls, and that's available in most primary care centres. So just look that there is available support out there without having to pay a fortune in advance, because I know that a lot of people will struggle to get appointments. And I'm talking about just atypical behaviours where we see them, you know, kids struggling. So Afif, tell us all, who is our guest this week?
So I am delighted to welcome Dr. Rebecca Quinn, who is a chartered clinical psychologist and is the director of the psychology practice Spray. and she founded that herself in early 2022. She's also the principal psychologist over three children's disability network teams in Wicklow, where she has worked for 12 years. Prior to this, Rebecca worked in the area of neuropsychology in Beaumont Hospital. She also worked in adult mental health in St. Patrick's Hospital and held a one-year post at the Institute of Psychiatry in London after she completed her training. She completed her psychology undergraduate in Trinity College before completing a master's in the Foundation of Clinical Psychology at the University of Wales. She completed her doctorate in clinical psychology at the University of Limerick. And she's also a member of PSI and the Autism Special Interest Group within the PSI. And her special areas of interest include anxiety, autism, and the relationship between physical activity and mental health. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us on the Baby Tribe podcast. I'm sure our conversation is going to spark interest to pretty much any parent with any child, because we're going to tackle two important topics, autism and temper tantrums slash meltdowns. But before we delve into it, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to the world of psychology?
First of all, thanks, Sophie, for having me here this morning. So I am a principal psychologist in Wicklow at the moment, and I work across three different teams. They're children's disability network teams. So I cover a wide range of ages from 0 to 18. And I also have my own private practice, which I do kind of on the side. So it's quite small. I'm a mum of three as well, so I come to this with a professional and a personal hat on, I guess. I first became interested in psychology as a teenager, actually. Well, I was going to go one of two routes, either down the psychology route or become a professional ballerina, believe it or not. So long story short, I went down the psychology route, but I did actually go back and mess around with the ballet stuff for a while I was doing my doctoral training. But anyway, that's a story for another day. So, yeah, I just always wanted to pursue a career in psychology, just fascinated with the human mind, how it works, and particularly just the potential that people have that they maybe don't realise and don't fulfil. That always just fascinated me. It was a long road, about 8-9 years in total, and then became interested in the area of disability when I started my job in Enable Ireland in Bray about 13 years ago. I'll be very honest, the reason I actually took that job was because it was close to home. I had been working in neuropsychology in Beaumont Hospital for a year before that, but the commute from Bray was just enormous. So I took the job in Bray, but then just fell in love with working with children in particular. I just feel there's so much scope for intervention at that age. It very much enjoyed working with the systems around the child. Like, it was such a varied job, and it still is. You get to work with schools, parents, and the child. So to this day, love what I do.
Yeah, and there's a huge demand for it at the moment, because there's an increasing recognition that all of these issues are either becoming more prevalent, or we are increasing our recognition of them. And you might maybe clarify which one it is, or whether it's a combination of both. I suppose let's jump right into it. Autism Spectrum Disorder, or ASD, is something that is on the minds of a lot of parents. And I know from my experience with dealing with newborns, regardless of whether the babies are born prematurely or at term, one big thing that parents ask me sometimes when I'm looking at their children throughout the first year, do you think my baby has autism? Are there any symptoms of autism? And on that, could you explain to us what autism spectrum disorder is and how it varies from child to child?
Yeah. In medical terms, I suppose it's a neurodevelopmental condition, which implies that it can be identified from a young age. Often it can, but often it's identified later in life. It is basically, in essence, a different way of experiencing the world. And that manifests in mostly three different ways in terms of social interaction, communication, and also different behaviours, and sensory experiences can be different as well. It is more prevalent in boys than in girls. So for every one girl, on average, three boys will be diagnosed with autism. They estimate that the incidence in Ireland at the moment is 1 in 50, which is really increased relative to years ago. There's been many different suggested causes for autism over the past number of decades. Several environmental factors have been suggested as being a cause for autism, but none of these have actually been proven. And most of the evidence really, or most of the scientific study, center around a genetic link. Hundreds of different genes have been studied. They focus on six in particular that focus on the gene that's related to synaptic development and neuron development as well. So that's more of the science end of it. But yeah, it's considered a spectrum condition because it manifests so differently in each individual. So as the saying goes, once you've met one autistic person, you've met just one autistic person. And I think for many of the parents that you might meet, Afif, they, for example, I notice parents maybe see that their child is walking on their toes a lot, and they think that that one feature is indicative of autism, whereas that's not the case. You need to have a number of different features present in the three different areas that I mentioned, and you need to meet the diagnostic criteria in order to receive a diagnosis of autism.
And I think that's an important point you bring up, is that we touched on this in a previous episode of The Baby Tribe, whereas we were talking about there are some certain behaviours or developmental attributes that some normal children may possess in isolation. That doesn't mean that they're going to end up having autism or any other neurodevelopmental disorder. It is more of observing a pattern and maybe a combination of different symptoms that might end up leading us to the diagnosis. So that's an important thing to get across. And on that, what are the early signs that parents should look out for? And generally, what age do they begin to become apparent?
As I mentioned earlier, in some children, it becomes more apparent at an earlier stage. But often parents will tell me that they have noticed something different within within the first 36 months. But it can be noticed even earlier than that. And again, like as I mentioned, you're looking for differences or challenges in one of the three, across the three different areas that I mentioned. So in terms of the communication challenges, they may have differences in their eye contact. They may not look at you directly in the face. They may prefer to look to the side of your head. Just the quality of their eye contact might be different. Social responses might be different. So they may not respond to their name. That can be quite an indicator. They may not know or understand kind of conventional gestures like, you know, big surprising faces or waves or blowing kisses. They may not reciprocate with those kind of gestures. Joint attention might not be there. So what I mean by that, Afif, is if, for example, I was to point to something over there, more often than not, an infant will look over in that direction. To share what you're looking at, to share the what you're attending to, whereas that often might not be present in autistic children. Other things you might look out for then in terms of behaviours might be things like sensory aversions, or they may be seeking sensory experiences. So they may be kind of rocking back and forth to get that sensory feedback, walking on their toes, flapping their hands is another feature. Or putting their hands in front of their eyes, like for that kind of visual stimulation. Other kind of apparent sensory issues that are evident from a young age might be a child that kind of puts their hands over their ears a lot, or that to avoid kind of loud noises. Also sensory aversions to food. So gagging or spitting things out can be another sign in young infants. So that's probably just some of the things to look out for. There's probably more. But again, like you mentioned, it's never just one thing. And I really hope to get that message out to parents today, that it's never just the one thing in isolation. It's a number of things in those three areas.
And the repetitive movements that have been classically attributed to this condition.
Yeah.
As you put it nicely, they are could be categorized as the sensory avoidance versus sensory seeking. Yeah. So, you know, that's what you're talking about, isn't that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So often autistic children and, you know, typically developing children as well, they seek proprioceptive input, which is feedback into their body that you get by pushing up against a hard surface or hugging yourself. And they can seek that out, or biting things as well. That gives nice kind of sensory feedback.
So
autistic children, they experience and maybe more sensory seeking than typically developing children.
So you've touched on this, Rebecca, already, but can you walk us through the process of diagnosing a child with ASD?
Yeah, so often referrals will come to us from a paediatrician or a PHN. They've noticed some differences or delays maybe in their development. We then, there's three routes at the moment, just to let people, make people aware, I suppose, that you can obtain a diagnosis through the public system on the Children's Disability Network team, the assessment of need, and then you may also choose to go down the private route as well. Some primary care teams will do an assessment, but not all. So it's a team-based assessment. It's quite a lengthy process. There is no, also just to say, there is no blood test for autism. Often parents ask me, oh, can we not just get a geneticist or something to test for this? But we can't. It's a behavioural observation assessment. So we gather information through a long assessment process whereby we observe different behaviours or not. The process starts off with a pretty long interview with parents. It can be about 3 hours long, called the ADIR or the DISCO. You can use either tool. There's an observation then of the child, a play-based observation, and we use a thing called the ADOS. That takes about roughly about an hour. Then there's often a speech and language therapy assessment, because what you want to do, Afif, is rule out other differentials. So often a child that has very delayed language and maybe has sensory needs as well can present as an autistic child, but may not meet the full criteria. So we do our speech and language therapy or speech and language assessment. We also do, not always, but often do a cognitive assessment to look at their thinking abilities. We like to do observations in different settings, because one of the diagnostic criteria is that these difficulties or challenges need to be present in different areas and not just in one. So we like to observe the child maybe in preschool and in the clinic setting and maybe at home as well. So all in all, I would say it takes about, it's roughly between 27 and 35 hours to complete an assessment from start to finish. That does include the report writing and the feedback and everything. So once you've gathered all your behavioural observations, what you do is you map them on then to whatever diagnostic criteria you're going to use. So you can use the DSM or the ICD-11, and they're just ways of different approaches to categorising various conditions. And you see if there's sufficient evidence to support the diagnosis as per the DSM or the ICD-11. And again, there has to be challenges in each of the three different areas that I've mentioned earlier. Then you write your report, you give your feedback and recommendations to the parent. Yeah, that probably summarizes the process.
So I think what I'm getting from you is, you know, often parents think that they have, you know, picked up on the condition, and you've just described how complex the process can be to actually establish a diagnosis. And that is probably reassuring to parents that are listening, that it takes such a long time of spending with the child, doing various tests, doing various observations, to actually come up with the diagnosis, because of the fact that it is a multifactorial thing in terms of the things that you're looking at. It also demonstrates why the diagnosis can't be made, you know, in the early few months of the infant's life. Yeah. It's because of the fact that you actually need to go through these processes in a way that the child can engage with.
Yeah, 100%. And you also need to give time for the child to develop. And this is something that's coming up now. It's a pattern that we've noticed. So because, as you're probably aware, there are significant wait lists on the CDNT and everywhere, really. So what we have are PHNs and GPs maybe, and families themselves. And I can understand why, referring a child in at a very, very young age just so that they will get seen. But then oftentimes by the time the assessment comes around, the child has maybe just developed. There may have just been a little lag in development, and then suddenly their speech comes on. So they're referring at a young age now for fear of missing out on an assessment. But you're right. I mean, we need to give children some time. Early intervention is important, but equally giving the child some time to develop is also important.
And on that note, and you've mentioned how there's long waiting lists for these services, how can parents actually advocate for their child's need and ensure that they receive the appropriate support in an environment where it sometimes can be hard to get the support and you may be waiting for a long period of time?
Yeah. So probably the best way around that, Afif, is first of all getting the assessment. And to speed that up, I would suggest to parents that the assessment of need process is probably the fastest way to get an assessment, because you're legally, the HSE is legally obliged to complete that assessment within a certain time frame. Also, going privately is another fast route. Not that that's how, you know, it's not ideal, but if a parent wants that diagnosis early, that is one of the best ways of doing it. After that, I suppose knowledge is power, really linking in with, so once, if your child does receive a diagnosis, linking in with the relevant support agencies is vital. And they might include, as I am, for example, have an excellent handbook for parents that have been, where their child has been just diagnosed. And it gives you a map as to all the different things that you need to do, from, you know, accessing the right preschool, looking at different schools, getting in touch with the SENO, the special educational needs officer, who will be familiar with all the different schools that your child may be able to attend. Just knowing what services are out there. But again, the first point of contact should really be one of those charitable organisations that work with autistic children and with their families.
Can you tell us some effective strategies that parents can adopt to help bring on the development and support of a child with ASD?
It depends, I guess, on the child's needs. So in each of the different three areas that I mentioned, a child may have significant challenges or not so many challenges. So in communication, for example, depending on their preferred mode of communication, some children may be non-speaking, so that the parent might choose to look into getting visuals to support the child, or alternative and augmentative communication strategies, so AAC, such as an iPad. In the area then of sensory needs, they may consider getting an occupational therapy assessment to look at the sensory profile of the child, after which then a sensory diet can be drawn up to see what the child needs in terms of sensory input to help them keep regulated throughout the day. In the behavioural domain then, a lot of autistic children will experience meltdowns due to social demands of the situation, sensory overload and so on. And they may require support of a positive behaviour support worker or a psychologist to help with those different needs.
Great. Yeah. A couple of final questions on autism before we move on to temper tantrums. There's a lot of myths and misconceptions about things that cause autism. Two big things that come to my mind are vaccinations, the MMR vaccine, and also screen time. Mm. So can you tell us why we should debunk those myths?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. First of all, there is no evidence to support them. There was a study in 1998. It was the Wakefield study that was basically withdrawn because it claimed that MMR caused autism. But it was found to be methodologically flawed and just a lot of inconsistencies in it, and some unethical behaviours as well. Anyway, so it's been withdrawn. There's no evidence for it.
Yeah.
And similarly with the screen time, there is no evidence for that either. Certainly, screen time can and has been shown to increase the likelihood of meltdowns once we're off the screen, but it's not said to be causal in terms of autism.
Absolutely. And I've read a lot of literature suggesting that infants or young children that may end up developing ASD may have a propensity to screen time.
Exactly.
You know, so it's probably
chicken and egg situation.
Exactly,
you're right. It's the visual stimulation, and it's also the fact that it's in their control, and they know what's happening. And just the sensory feedback is quite, especially the visual, is fantastic. A lot of those children are also just drawn to visuospatial stuff. That's their strength or their special interest, which is another reason why they're drawn to it.
Use of paracetamol during pregnancy, that has sometimes been ascribed to it. It's not something, and I've looked into it quite in depth. And again, I don't see a definite or even a suggestion of a link between that and developing autism down the line. That's not something you've heard of either.
No. And even I have read up on this to make sure that I was aware of all the environmental causes or things like that. And no, the only, like, the evidence is strongest for a genetic link.
Exactly.
And
then finally on that, there's no link between prematurity and an increased risk of autism down the line, is there?
There is a lot of research on that, and it has been suggested that there has been a link, but again, it hasn't been determined to be causal, no.
Yeah, and I suppose it's important to emphasise that association does not imply causation.
Yeah, exactly, or correlation.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not the same,
Exactly. And in your overall view in children and individuals with ASD, the overall long-term outlook in terms of functioning within society. Do you see it being favourable now with earlier recognition and the and the supports that they get early on?
Yeah, it is becoming more favourable. I think we do have a long way to go. It also depends, though, on the co-occurrence of other conditions with autism. So if a child does present, for example, with a significant learning disability and autism, or there's more challenges for that child in terms of integrating into society. But yes, we are becoming more more aware, and education is moving in the right direction. Yeah, there is still probably a long way to go in many aspects, but yeah, like you say, there is more awareness, there are more assessments. I do think sometimes there is a danger of tokenistic behavior. So for example, like having a sensory area in a school or in a shopping center, for example, designated to autistic people, but actually it's there, but it's completely inappropriate, or it's in the wrong place, or it's not actually sensory friendly, for example. So that is something I think we need to make sure. We need to be led by autistic people, and they need to have input into the adaptations that we make and how we make it in society inclusive, yeah, rather than us deciding what it should be. You know?
Absolutely. I think there's a big recognition that we actually need to involve more of the people with the condition into helping us learn how to manage it for them. And with their support. I think that's a great way to pivot now from autism to temper tantrums. Up until recently, actually, and that's probably something I shouldn't admit to everybody, I didn't realize that there was a difference between a temper tantrum and a meltdown. So could you tell us the difference between the two?
And it's not surprising. We use the terms interchangeably. I do as well. So that is nothing to be ashamed of. Because on the external characteristics are very similar, right? But internally, they're driven by different factors. So a tantrum typically is driven by that desire for independence, control, or it's a frustration because a certain something isn't being achieved or avoided, actually. Whereas the meltdown is more a state of overwhelm, which is caused by sensory overload or, for example, in autistic children, excess social demand. So they're not trying to necessarily assert control or independence or get something. It's just almost a biological state of dysregulation because of this sensory overload on their system. They are a child's way of, so if a child has a feeling, an urge or a sensation that's just so overwhelming, it kind of comes out of their body in behavior because they don't yet have the words to express them. And that's like an important point to make. Like, they are a normal, healthy part of development. It's a child expressing their need or their want for something. And I think we need to accept that the children are doing this, because we can't expect a child to be subservient and compliant and not express their needs, but then later in life to be assertive, you know, when we've shut down all their expressions of need. When they're younger. But yeah, it's a very normal part of development, and that part of the brain that helps us to control our impulses and regulate our behaviours, that helps us to plan, make proper decisions, that is not developed yet. The prefrontal cortex is not developed in infants, and it's not fully developed until we're in our mid-20s. And it doesn't really start to come online until around the age of 6 or 7. So I suppose we cannot expect our children to, our toddlers even, to manage these big emotions that are coming from their amygdala or their survival brain when they don't have the brain architecture to do so.
So on that then, when do they usually start?
The tantrums?
Yeah.
They can start as young as one, I've seen. Yeah.
So I'm going to tell you a personal story that still sticks in my head of my daughter when she was 2. We were in Canada.
Yeah.
And we were both working busy jobs doing our fellowships, and I had to bring her to her creche, and it's usually a 10-minute walk, but I was in a rush that day. I was going to be late for work, and I said to my daughter, "We're not walking today." She usually enjoys the walk. "We're not walking today. I'm putting you in a carriage." We used to have these almost go-kart things that you put a child in and then you pull them.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Maggie, you're sitting here and I'm going." And she was having none of it. She wanted to walk. So What I did was to try and get my way was I put her in and I started walking really fast so that she couldn't actually get out.
Yeah.
And she screamed in the middle of downtown Toronto for the whole kilometer and a half.
Yeah.
Wow. And but she screamed so much that cops were stopping to see if I was kidnapping the child, you know. And I was going, yeah. Please make the stop. Please make the stop. You know, yeah, when everybody was turning at you. So this is a long-winded way of asking what can parents do? What are effective ways to kind of respond to a temper tantrum?
Yeah, yeah. It's so difficult, isn't it? And that's where you start, though, is with your regulation of yourself. Well, first of all, I think acceptance that it's happening, because the more you try to shut it down, the more it will escalate in all likelihood. And I think like understanding the reasons why it's there. For example, your daughter was asserting her independence. She wanted to walk. She can't give you the words fully yet, or maybe she could.
Oh, she could. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm glad she didn't know any curse words at the time. Yeah. Otherwise, I would have heard them. Yeah.
Yeah. But she wants her way, and it's her becoming her little independent self, which is the job of a toddler. But sometimes I think understanding that in the moment allows us to accept it in the moment, which then allows us to kind of soften a little bit in the moment. Because the more you resist, the more your nervous system is escalated and the more theirs becomes escalated. So acceptance is the first kind of point. Then I think regulating yourself as best you can. So in that moment, for example, I'm not sure. Well, I guess you were moving. So at least that was helping you to regulate yourself. A time when you can't move, I find that like grounding myself, even with a kind of a tactile cue, like reminding myself to keep my cool, you know, and I find deep breathing. Now, I don't mean like, you know, 10 minutes of yoga breathing or anything, because you don't have time in the moment, but even just breathing in through your nose. And I find I kind of have to verbally express it in some way. I just might say, oh my God, this is so hard. You know, I might say it under my breath or something like that. And that really actually helps, rather, because it gives me that pause, and the power is in the pause, as they say. And in that pause, you can then choose to have a different response to the one that you may have had if you didn't do that. You then want to move into, I suppose, understanding that negotiating isn't going to work in this moment when your child is screaming, because they're in full kind of fight or flight mode. Like that survival brain is kicking in. They're full of cortisol and adrenaline. They're not in that frame of mind where they're going to be able to rationally reason with you. Usually repetitive and rhythmic, as they say, movement can help a child in that moment. So just even soothing them, that's if they'll allow you close to them. Often they won't. But if they do, kind of hugs and soothing them, which can be really hard if you're dysregulated yourself, which is why the regulation step comes first. But even moving them to another place, bringing them outside, that movement helps them to regulate their midbrain. Talk less, move more is kind of nice little
rule of thumb. You can't negotiate with toddlers, basically.
Not really, no. Yeah. No, not when they're in tantrum mode. Yeah.
The typical scenario that a lot of people talk about is a child in the supermarket that wants something. Yeah. And you say no, and then they're literally on the floor.
Yeah.
And I remember my son used to do that, but my wife used to just completely ignore him, step over him on the floor and keep shopping.
Yeah.
But it's sometimes hard to do that because you're worried about what other people are going to say, whether you're going to be judged. And we talk about judgment, especially towards mothers.
Yeah.
Look at this. She can't control her child. Mm-hmm. What message do you give to mums in that situation? Because it's usually mums that are dealing with this issue.
Yeah. So, and I've been there myself. And the first step is almost like putting on kind of blinders and going, right, regulate myself. And all of those voices, like they're just thoughts coming through your mind, right? Oh, they're going to judge me. Are they going to call Tusla? Are they going to do this? What are they thinking? All of that. They're just thoughts. Try to put them aside. Breathe through them. If you want to entertain one thought, entertain this, that 99% of the other adults in that supermarket have been in a similar situation. You know, if you want to entertain thinking about other people, entertain that thought. Usually, I think it depends on the child, like, and it depends on what's going on. It might be the case that you can regulate them with a hug or, you know, validating. I know you really want that right now. we're not getting it right now. So you empathize, you validate, but you put in the boundary. And that is our job as parents, really. So you're empathizing that I know you're really upset. I know you want the Paw Patrol mug. We can't get that today. Let's put it down on the list. Maybe we'll get it another day. And then we walk over to distract with something else. Okay. If that doesn't work, if they're in full kind of, you know, trashing mode on the floor, usually the best thing is, and I've had to do this, put the basket back somewhere, like forget about what's in it, whatever, and just lift the child up and walk outside. Okay. It is often, especially if they're potentially going to danger themselves by smashing something off a shelf or whatever. Safety is one of the first things to consider in that moment, yeah, if it has become physical.
Do you ever see a situation where a parent just gives in to the child is wanting?
All the time.
That's okay to do sometimes, yeah, as well. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So parents aren't a failure. Yeah, exactly.
No.
Yeah.
No, because, and I like working with autistic parents, I feel that so deeply. Please, you know, don't judge parents for that snapshot that you see them, because you do not know what has gone on before at home, what they're facing afterwards, what their current life situation is. And maybe that was just the straw that was going to break the camel's back for them, and they just really had to give in that moment. And it is absolutely fine. Pick your battles.
That's a very important message to send to parents.
Yeah. You know, I think we're often afraid, or we become uncomfortable when we see other parents trying to manage a tantrum. But, you know, even, do you want me to hold your basket there? Look, I've been there. I'll hold the basket. You do whatever.
And do you think parents of the tantruming child, do you think that they appreciate it?
I think by and large, yes, actually. Yeah. Yeah. I think they'd appreciate it much more than an eye roll or just, you know, being ignored. For example, I know it happened to me. Now, it's maybe easier for me because I see a lot of this type of behavior in my work. But there was a lady once who was struggling to get a child into the car. She had the trolley. The trolley was moving backwards. Anyway, I caught the trolley and I just pushed it up to the lady. And she actually just burst out crying. She's like, thank you so much. This is such a hard day, blah, blah, blah. And I think the child in the car got such a fright that the mum was crying that the child actually
stopped,
settled as well.
No, that's a great message to send out. Mm. And just finally on that, at what point do you think temper tantrums indicate a deeper issue?
So I think if they're quite excessive, so you want to think about the three things: frequency, intensity, duration. So if they're a lot of them happening during the day, if they're very intense, like really physical, and if it's been going on for a long time, then you want to wonder, you know, is there some medical issue going on where there's maybe underlying pain or something? Or is it a sign of a neurodevelopmental condition either? Or is there some sensory thing going on whereby the child is in constant sensory overload? Also, if you see excessive tantrums going on beyond the age that they're expected to kind of peter out a bit, so which is kind of 8 or 9, you kind of expect to see them like definitely to be reducing at least at that stage. But if they're still going on, then that's a time to kind of, maybe think about what might be going on in the child's kind of larger environment. And, you know, is it an expression of maybe, and which it can be, and I think parents don't realize this, it can be an expression of heightened anxiety, actually. Or if there's something very serious going on for that child in school or at home, it can manifest in tantrum type behaviors, particularly if it's an older child.
I'd love to chat to you forever. There's so much that we can learn from you. I just want to end on a final question. And that hopefully applies to parents in general. How can parents actually help their child develop better emotional regulation skills as they grow?
Sorry to tell you, the most effective way is actually adults modeling emotion regulation themselves. I'm so mindful of this, like, because I say this to parents every day. So then I'm like really trying to do it at home. But regulating and showing your children how you regulate your own emotions is key. There are other ways. You can talk about emotions and talk about emotion regulation using books when you're sitting down watching a film. There's lots of YouTube videos that are really helpful, and kids are really drawn towards those, as we know. It can also help to teach a child what their triggers are. There's lots of lovely little exercises. There's some on my Instagram page actually where you can, there's a trigger list and you sit down with your child and you identify what makes them kind of want to explode. And then that helps them to become aware. And then awareness is key then to them noticing and then maybe preventing their emotions getting to a 10 out of 10. Practicing the skills outside the moment is key, actually. So say, for example, you decide that deep breathing will be a good activity to do with my child. They seem to kind of buy into that. It's unreasonable to expect a child to suddenly be able to do deep breathing inside a tantrum moment. We need to teach them those skills when their brain is kind of calm and regulated outside the tantrum moment. So doing those deep breathing exercises using an app or something kind of cool and trendy that'll, you know, you'll buy the child in, I suppose. But teaching them outside of the moment is key for them to be able to then use it in the moment to regulate their emotions. And that stands to reason for whatever strategy it is that you pick to help your child with emotion regulation.
And finally, how can parents find more information, maybe through your page? What's your Instagram handle, actually?
Yeah, so it's at Dr. Rebecca Quinn. And I do have a resource hub, actually. It's just the highlight on my page. And in that, you will get links to, there's actually an emotion regulation workshop. It's a 2-part video workshop that brings you through actually loads of different ways to help your child with emotion regulation. And then my posts are largely informative. I need to do more reels, according to my son.
Yes, it's all in the reels these days.
Yeah, yeah.
So people, please head on over after listening and please go follow Dr. Rebecca Quinn. I know I have learned a lot from your page and I'm so glad that you decided to come and chat to us on the Baby Tribe. Thank you so much for giving us your time and this has been an amazing conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Baby Tribe podcast. We're delighted to have shared this time with you, offering guidance and support for your parenting journey.
I've been Afif and she's been Katie, and together we've been your guide in exploring the multifaceted world of parenting. Remember, every step you take in nurturing your child makes a world of difference.
Stay connected with us and don't miss our next episode, where we'll continue to delve into the valuable insights and practical tips for raising healthy and happy children. Thank you for being part of our tribe, and remember, you're doing an amazing job.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Head Stuff Plus.